Listen and stream the all-new talk radio, Freedom 106.5, for the only talk that matter.
It's just about 3 minutes after nine, and we are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas. Good morning to you guys, and a welcome.
Good morning, Kara. Good morning, Dr. Pandey. We have a special guest today. This is Dr. Avidesh Pandey. He's a neurologist and consultant physician attached to the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex of North Central Regional Health Authority. He practices internal medicine as well as neurology and neurophysiology. He graduated from the Faculty of Medical Sciences, University of the West Indies, San Augustine campus, and received his neurology training at the University of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He is a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians, London, and the European Board of Neurology. So we want to welcome Dr. Avidesh Pandey today. And one of the first questions I wanted to ask was, how long have you been practicing medicine and why did you choose neurology?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Nadira, and 106.5. Morning to all these listeners. And even though I may look very, very young, I've been in practice since 2007. And I've been practicing neurology since 2014. Why did I do it? Well, believe it or not, after internship, I thought I would have had a career in obstetrics and gynae. That was my original thought. I was going on that road. But I guess I just fell in love with internal medicine. And a large part of my training as a junior doctor were in neurology units, and I had some great teachers and mentors along the way, and here I am.
So what exactly is neurology?
Neurology is a subspecialty of internal medicine where we look at the illnesses affecting the brain, spine, nerve, and muscle. It's a very broad field. So many times we deal with complaints such as weakness, episodes of loss of consciousness, seizures, headaches, sometimes difficulties with vision. So neurology is very, very all-encompassing, and we tend to work quite a lot with various other subspecialties because, you know, the body is connected by many things. One of them are nerves. So any bodily system could have a neurological manifestation.
All right. And what are some of the more common disorders that you encounter in your practice?
Well, by far the most common, what we call the bread and butter of neurology, would be stroke, headaches, and seizures. Those are by far the three most common neurological conditions that we treat in the adult neurological clinic.
Do you see kids as in the pediatric population as well?
Well, some of my training would have been in pediatrics, but I do not consider myself to be a pediatric neurologist. There are more qualified persons that deal with them. So I would defer to the expertise of the pediatric neurologist, but I am capable of at least basic levels of pediatric care.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about headaches, any different types of headaches?
Well, that's a very hard question, and a question that can be 2 hours long, 3 hours long, but headaches are, most patients with headaches actually do not have a problem with their brain. Most times when you have headaches, it's a problem, something else. So let's just say I have a clinic with 10 patients. Six out of the 10 patients are going to come to me, "Doc, I have a headache." Mm-hmm. Our job when we start to speak about a headache is to look for red flags. What in this headache is going to make me think, all right, something's not right here? So I know I'm not answering your question specifically, but I, you know, this is an educational talk. So this would be of benefit to the listeners. You may have some of the red flags that we encounter in headaches that tell me, this patient needs further investigation, would be visual symptoms. If you're getting a headache and you've got a change in your typical visual symptom, in your vision, maybe double vision, maybe blurry vision, maybe your visual acuity is not as it should be. Other red flags would be headaches associated with drowsiness, headaches associated with loss of consciousness. Also, headaches associated with neurological weakness. So for example, doc, I'm getting a headache on my right side of my head, but I'm feeling weak on my left side. That's a red flag. There are many, many, many red flags, of course, headaches associated with fevers. So you're saying, doc, I had a fever, and I'm just getting this headache, it's not going away. So anytime we see patients with headaches and we've got these red flags, it tells us, this person requires maybe blood tests. This person may require some sort of imaging modality, maybe a CT scan or an MRI. Or in certain instances, if we are really worried, we'd admit this patient to hospital and do more advanced testing. So a headache is not just simply a headache. Many, many times, headaches are benign. They are tension headaches, stress headaches, dehydration headaches, hunger headaches, exhaustion headaches. Many times, especially in the female population, there are migraines. And the typical migraine is a patient who has a headache maybe four hours up to 72 hours. They tend to have nausea, vomiting, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity. The typical story is they go to sleep with the headache, they wake up in the morning, the headache is still there, and it's debilitating. Some patients may have these headaches associated with food triggers, of which, you know, typical triggers would be red wine, dark chocolate, cheese, nuts, coffee, caffeine, dairy. But,
Alcohol.
For some persons, now, no two people are alike. So different people have different triggers. And really and truly, no matter how much I would tell someone, look, these are the triggers, they would say, no, doc, my trigger is allergies. My trigger is Saharan dust. My trigger is certain types of lights, certain types of sounds, certain types of smells. There's some patients will say, look, if I spray insecticide, that will trigger off a headache. So you really have to figure out what your headache trigger is for yourself.
Right. And so migraines, you touched a little bit about migraines and the symptoms and the triggers. How exactly can they be treated at home, and when do patients normally have to seek medical care?
Well, Nadira, you know me. You know me a long time, and you know that I love analogies. So I use the analogy of a forest fire. A migraine is a forest fire, but a forest fire didn't start as a forest fire. It started as a little spark. So one of the common mistakes that people think with a migraine is, let me wait until it gets bad and then let me treat it. That's wrong. If you were to treat a migraine and with a little spark, you're more likely to succeed in early treatment than waiting for it to turn into this fire and you can't out it. So most people, they know when they're going to get a headache. They know it's coming on. They have that typical, what we call prodrome, that aura. They know, look, this is going to build up to one. So some patients, two paracetamols may be enough in the early infancy of the headache to take it away. Some people need higher, they need other medications such as ibuprofen or what we call the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And then some people, I call them the pros, they know about the other preparations such as ergotamine, known as vasogreen, and so on. Now, most people who have migraines have had migraines before, so they know what is normal for them. What I always say is that the following requires treatment: a change in pattern from your normal headache. So if this is different, if it's going on a little bit too long, if it's not responding to your typical medications, and another one that bothers me is when you're taking too many medications. In neurology, we talk about things called primary headaches, and then we have secondary headaches. So the typical story is you have a patient with migraine, and they know it's a migraine. They take their medications, pain is gone. 2 days later, another headache comes in. And then, lo and behold, a month has gone by, and they've taken about 25, 26 paracetamols. So they've now gone on, now it's a secondary headache known as a medication overuse headache. So these patients are having two types of headaches. So just as you get rid of one, you have a second one. And then you have this cycle of continuous pain. And that's when you have to see us for detoxification and addition of what we call prophylactic medications.
Right. Some migraines, some sufferers, they have neurological symptoms. When should those patients get worried?
Well, there are different types of migraines. So for example, there are some, it's called migraines with aura. So there are some patients will say, look, my vision has changed. Just prior to the headache, I get these flashing lights, I get this kaleidoscope of colors, and then the headache comes and then I'm back to normal. And then there are some patients with migraines who say, look, after the headache, one half of my body is weak. When there's no way that I can sit down here and tell you what is a red flag and what isn't, because I mean, I have to see a patient. But if you think that something is wrong or something is different from your norm, I advise you, you know, just get checked by your physician, whomever it may be.
Right. Switching gears a little bit, could you tell us a little bit about something called trigeminal neuralgia? Like what trigeminal, where the trigeminal nerve is and what neuralgia means?
Okay. So trigeminal neuralgia is similar in a way to migraines in that they are what we call pain syndromes. So the difference is that whereas migraines are considered a headache, trigeminal neuralgia is considered a facial, it's called facial pain. Now, the common story is that most patients with trigeminal neuralgia, they see the dentist first because they are almost always certain that this is some sort of dental problem. And very often they may have a root canal, they may have a dental procedure, they may have an extraction, and then the pain is still there. And then they get referred on to the neurologist. And trigeminal neuralgia is exactly what it is. Trigeminal, because it's the trigeminal nerve, and neuralgia comes from new nerve, algia, pain. So whenever we say neuralgia, it means nerve pain. So trigeminal neuralgia, trigeminal nerve pain. And if you go just in front of your ear, that's where the trigeminal nerve comes out. And there are three branches, one going up to the eye, well, one going up to the temple, one going in the direction of the eye, one going down to the jaw. So depending on which branch is inflamed, you will get pain starting at the ear, and it may be shooting down to the jaw, to the teeth, or behind the eye. A lot of these patients say that they feel this sensation in their ear, and they would see an ENT. They may see two ENTs because they're convinced something is wrong with the ear, but there's never a problem. So very often, a trigeminal neuralgia patient sees a dentist or two, an ENT or two, prior to seeing the neurologist.
And how do we normally treat trigeminal neuralgia?
Well, if you take a hammer or if you bounce your foot on the door, you're going to take painkillers. You're going to take regular musculoskeletal painkillers. You're going to take things like ibuprofen, Aleve, Advil, and so on. Those medications do not work in trigeminal neuralgia because neuralgia means nerve pain. So you have to use medications specific for the nerve. So we use medications like carbamazepine and pregabalin, also known as Lyrica, and so on. And some instances, the medications do not work. So failure of medication is defined as two or more medications on board but not adequate relief of pain. Now, to understand how to treat trigeminal neuralgia, what you have to do is you have to understand the concept of this. If I'm playing football and I graze my foot, you know, in Trinidad, we have a saying, you get a white man. A white man is when you graze your foot against terrazzo or concrete or whatever. So that means your skin now is red, is raw. It's going to burn like hell. Picture you have a normal blood vessel and you have a normal nerve. normal, but they're rubbing against each other. So that means your nerve is raw, and that's why you get trigeminal neuralgia. Now, the definite, so we usually do an MRI scan of the brain just to determine the proximity of the artery and the vein, or the artery and the nerve, and in some instances, make sure it's nothing else. If it is that they are touching, kissing, or wrapping around each other, the definitive surgery, the definitive treatment would be open it up. And that's by a cut behind the ear. You expose that part of the brain and you put a piece of cloth, also known as a mesh, so that it no longer rubs against each other. But there are other treatments available for people who do not want surgery. There's something called cyberknife surgery, which is, you know, just to simplify it, a laser, and they burn the nerve. So it's no cutting, no recovery, it's very quick. And it's much safer than surgery. But of course, it doesn't work as good as surgery, because there may be some degree of the success ratio may be a bit less.
Do B complexes help for nerve pain on a whole?
I know you're going to ask that question. Now, this is my opinion. This is not the opinion of, this is my opinion. If you are not B deficient, B complex is not going to help. It's just placebo. So I'm not sure a B injection going to help you if you're not B12 deficient. Yes, you may find a study here, you may find a study there to say it may help you, but I'm not certain it does.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Pandya. I believe we have to go to a break right now. We'll be right back with Doctors on Call with Dr. Avidesh Pandey.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
Just about 23 minutes after 9, and you are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambokas, along with Dr. Avidesh Pandey. And we are discussing neurological issues. Good morning and welcome back.
Thank you, Carol. So, Dr. Pandey, we talked a little bit about headaches and about trigeminal neuralgia. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about seizures. What exactly is a seizure?
Well, a seizure is a physical manifestation of an abnormal electrical rhythm. So, your brain is divided into the right half and the left half. So, in a normal brain, electricity is moving in one pattern, in one flow, and that's a good circuit. So your brain is like a circuit. Now, if you take a circuit at home and you take a drop of water on that circuit, you're going to get a spark. And that spark, similarly in the brain, will disrupt the electricity, and that may cause a seizure. So if it's one where there's no movement, you may have a blank stare. In some instances, you may not even have a blank stare. The patient may speak, but we will say speaking nonsense. They may just be disoriented. And then, of course, we have the big one that we all are accustomed to, the ones where there's violent shaking. So not all seizures are violent shaking. There are different types of seizures, and it corresponds to the degree of abnormal electricity in the brain.
So the different types of seizures, what are some of the risk factors for these types of seizures?
Well, first of all, before we go into there, you have to understand that there's a big difference between seizures and epilepsy. Not everybody with a seizure disorder would be considered an epileptic, but in order to be epileptic, you must have seizures. What do I mean? 9 to 10% of the population, you go in a room, you take 100 people, 9 or 10 of them will have at least one seizure in their lives. So epilepsy is defined as recurrent seizures, meaning more than one seizure, more than 24 hours apart. So that's when you consider a patient epileptic. In terms of risk factors, the first risk factor is having something in the brain that shouldn't be there, such as a tumor, a stroke, scarring of the brain. But epilepsy is really a pediatric diagnosis. Most patients with epilepsy present with seizures in the pediatric age range. So some of the risk factors would be, and this is actually something very important, high fevers in infancy, something known as febrile seizures. If children have high fevers that are left untreated, they can be developmental abnormalities of the brain, which may result in scarring and a predisposition towards seizures later on in life. Of course, some children, babies, as they develop, there's something called abnormal migration of cells in the brain, which can predispose you to seizures. And of course, head trauma, for example, a hard fall, which may cause disruption in the circuitry and these sorts of things. So, and of course, many times you do an MRI scan and it's normal. And then you're like, how could I have seizures if my MRI is normal? Because this is at a microscopic level. This is at a cellular level. So just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that's why we use tools such as electroencephalography to assist us in diagnosing these conditions.
So basically, seizures are treated depending on the cause, right?
So... No. Seizures are treated by what we call anticonvulsants, also known as antiepileptics. Mm-hmm. So irrespective of the cause, the treatment would be the same. The treatment dependent on the cause occurs if you failed medications. But not everybody with a seizure requires treatment. Like, I'll give you an example. Very, very, very often, I am faced with a patient between the ages of 16 and 18, either writing CXE or A-levels, and these parents are not too keen on commencing medications. Why? Because side effects. And you have a bright child, and you're thinking, well, they had two seizures 1 year apart, but do I give them a medication every day, which will make them forgetful, dizzy, drowsy? So it's really a balancing act. And really and truly, the treatment of a big part of the treatment of seizures is education, making patients, relatives, and stakeholders, inclusive of teachers in the school, principal, whomever, understand what it is. You may not be required to treat these seizures. Just as with a migraine, where you may have a precipitant, some patients with seizures, they know they're precipitant. So, of course, if they avoid it, they're not going to get seizures. So that's a big topic, and not everybody with epilepsy are on treatment.
So how can persons at home manage a relative or someone that they know who has seizures? How can they manage them, especially when they're having an event?
Well, before we talk about the event, how can you manage them? You have to make your home seizure safe, a seizure safe area. So a very simple thing would be, one, if they're going in the bathroom, don't lock your door. If you're going in your room, don't lock your door, because if you get a seizure, you're going to be unconscious and you can't get access to that room. You must not be in a hot tub. You must not be in a bath by yourself, because you can drown. Some patients have seizures only in the night. So it may be worthwhile to, if it's a young child, sleep with the parents, or have a sibling sleep in the same room. Or you can have, you know, the baby monitor. You keep a baby monitor in so you know if something's going, is happening. You should not be operating on ledges. So you shouldn't put a patient with seizures to go on a ladder, because if you get a seizure on the ladder, you're going to fall. So it's really about making the home as safe as possible should you have a seizure. Of course, should you have a seizure, you always put the patient on the lateral position. You turn them to your side. Couple don'ts. Do not put something in the mouth. Never, ever do that. I have heard in my practice, which is not very long, I've heard some remarkable things that people do. Put nutmeg in the mouth. Put a spoon in the mouth. Put your hands in the mouth. Imagine the force of your jaw coming down on a hand with full contractions. You could bite someone's hands off, or you can literally create some serious abrasions. You do not do that. You turn them on their side, so it's impossible to, as they say, swallow your tongue. You do not hug them. You do not do that, because when they come out of the seizure, they're confused. They may think someone is trying to attack them. So that may then precipitate another seizure or violence. You ensure that they're on the ground and you make sure there's nothing that can fall on them, such as near to a shelf or something like that.
What about driving and patients who suffer with seizures or on medication for seizure disorder?
Well, Gil, you're asking a very contentious topic, because if there are any legal minds or lawyers listening on this, they may beg to disagree, because we are you have the medical answer and you have the legal answer, and there isn't actually any legislature on driving with epilepsy, either commercially or private use, because you would see the form, you've done it many times, that people have for license. That's only done at a certain age, and there's no real part for seizures. But the best practice dictates, and I am sort of partial to the North American rules, because I would have trained there. They usually actually dictate that for seizure, you do not drive for 3 months after until you're seizure-free, whether you are on meds or not. And in the instance of an industrial driver, a lorry driver, 1 year. If you are seizure-free, but you decide, look, doc, I'm seizure-free, I'm doing real good, but I want to come off of medication, you actually should surrender your license while coming off medication, because you could have a rebound seizure. So one of the things that I would, you know, I would be very happy to assist on, or if ever should you need arises, to, you know, formulate some best practices for driving and patients with epilepsy.
Okay. Switching gears a little bit about seizures and headaches and trigeminal neuralgia, one of the callers prior wanted to discuss a little bit about muscular dystrophy.
Gosh, Gail, give him, you know, today's Carnival Thursday, right? We're supposed to be talking about who we think we're going to win Road March. You know, you're going from trigeminal neuralgia to now muscular dystrophy. You're not giving him a chance today, but that's okay. That's okay. Muscular dystrophy is, as the name implies, muscular, muscle, dys means abnormal, trophy means size. So when you really break it down, muscular dystrophy means abnormal muscle size. That's all it means. Now, we love muscles, and we're in the time of the year for muscles. You go to the gym, everybody working on their muscles. Carnival Monday and Tuesday, everybody's showing off their muscles. So it's an appropriate question. Muscular dystrophy is part of a group of disorders that affects muscles known as a myopathy. So a patient will present with weakness. So the typical weakness is not of limb weakness per se, but of what we call proximal weakness. You're sitting on a chair, you have difficulty to get up. You're trying to hold something, you could grip good, you can grip good, but you find lifting something is difficult, and it's usually progressive. So when these things happen, you start to wonder, why am I weak? Why am I not doing? Why am I able to not walk as much as I could have? Why when I go to the groceries now, I can't take these things out of the trunk anymore? And that's a myopathy. And then now it's our job when they come to us to figure out, well, what is the cause of the muscle problem? So more common causes of a muscle problem would be a nutritional problem. Are you B12 deficient? Are you getting enough protein? Are you okay in terms of your hormones, your thyroid, and all of these things? So after we do that now, we then start to wonder, okay, let's look at the muscle size. So then we may do a biopsy. And then when you do the biopsy, you see, this muscle is no longer replaced by muscle, but it's a lot of fat. So even though the muscle is looking bulky, it's more fat, it's more scarring than it is muscle. and that's called muscular dystrophy, abnormal muscle. So it gives you the illusion that you have big muscles, but it's not really muscular tissue, it's something else. Many times now, we do not need to do a biopsy because it's a genetic condition. So it tends to run in families, and we are therefore able to diagnose a lot of muscle problems with genetic testing.
Right. So the treatment will depend on what the cause is?
Unfortunately, for muscular dystrophy, there is no cure because it's a genetic problem. Of course, there are studies into genetic therapy and so on, but it's a progressive problem. And not only does it affect your skeletal muscles, which are your what we call your short-term muscles, but it affects your muscles for breathing. So patients lose mobility because they get short of breath very quickly. And it's a very unfortunate condition because your lifespan is curtailed a bit. Mm-hmm. And it's progressive. So your treatment is not curative. Your treatment is to alleviate some of the symptoms.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Pandey. This is Doctors on Call. We're going for a brief break, and when we're back, we'll talk more about neurological issues with Dr. Avidish Pandey.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
Welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM. We are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. Avidish Pandey. Now, today, don't forget, guys, you can call us up. Our lines are always open. I know you have questions for our doctors, 627-3223 or 625-2257. You can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. Welcome back, doctors.
Thank you, Cara. Dr. Pandey, I'm going to ask you a little bit about what is a stroke or a cerebrovascular accident, since it's most common.
So essentially, a stroke is where a part of the brain has become devoid of blood flow. So eventually that part of the brain dies, and that's why it's called a stroke. It's called a cerebrovascular accident. Now, going back to the analogy, because again, you know, I like my analogies. Picture you have a house, a three-story house. You have the vas main, which is your major artery coming in. And then smaller pipes. So by the time you reach the vanity upstairs in the third floor, it's a small pipe. If you have an obstruction to the small pipe, only the room upstairs is going to have a problem. So you're only going to get a stroke in that part. But if you have a blockage to the vas main, the entire house is going to be devoid of oxygen. So you're going to get a bigger stroke. So a stroke is one of the vessels become blocked, or you may have bleeding, and then the corresponding area of the brain gets no oxygen and therefore dies.
Can you explain some of the symptoms that usually accompany a stroke and when you should seek medical care?
Well, you should always seek medical care immediately. Time is brain. Time is brain. Essentially, when you have a stroke, there is a part of the brain that is already gone, and then there is a part of the brain that is threatened. So for example, let's go back to the house. Suppose you have a problem in the vas main, but it's not a big clot, but it is enough to obstruct the flow upstairs. That part is gone, but the second floor is threatened. And unless you remove that clog in the vas main, the second floor and potentially the first floor is going to be damaged. So when you get a stroke, the aim is to minimize the amount of tissue that has been lost and prevent conversion of the threatened tissue into permanently damaged tissue. So time is brain. The faster you act, the more likely you are to minimize the stroke. And a stroke symptom is anything: loss of consciousness, limb weakness, facial weakness, slurry speech. Sometimes a stroke could present with a seizure. So it could be anything.
Hmm. We have a call here. Let's take this line. Hi, good morning. You're live. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi, morning.
Good morning.
I would like to say good morning going out to Hasina Khan and Mike and family. And good morning to you and your family. Have a pleasant day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is Freedom 106.5 FM. It's just about 9:45, and that was my time check. Dr. Pandey, I was listening to you before, and you were speaking about a fever in children. And, you know, if it goes to their head, you know, it would cause some serious damage. Now, let me just take this call, and then I'll continue my question to you, right? Hi, good morning. You're live.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling to ask Dr. Pandey a question about forgetfulness. You know, like some people, it's not Alzheimer's, but they forget incidents and they forget. And they have the memory of in the past, you know, early past, but within recent times, forgetting things that happens. Is that related to damage of the brain or whatever?
That's a very good question, and I'll be happy to answer it now if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So just to expand a little bit, there are three stages of memory: concentration, short-term memory, long-term memory. When you're young, you could be on the TV, on the phone, and your mom calling you, and you could concentrate on all of those things at the same time.
Mm.
So if I were to tell you something, go downstairs, pick up 10 things, bring it upstairs. If you're not concentrating on what I'm telling you, you're going to forget. That doesn't mean you forgot. It means you weren't concentrating to begin with. Mm. And as you get older, your powers of concentration reduce. So it is quite normal that your brain may play tricks on you. And you may think that you're forgetting and you're going to get worried, because we always worry about the D word, dementia. So you have concentration, short-term memory, and then you have long-term memory. Before you reach dementia, everybody has what is called age-appropriate memory loss. You can't be sharp. Now, there are people, don't get me wrong. I have some 95-year-old patients who put me to shame. But you can't be sharp as you get older. It is expected that you're going to have some degree of forgetfulness. When that forgetfulness becomes a bit more concerning, meaning that the family members are like, look, something not right here. They go into the bank, they're making a mistake. They go into the grocery, they're buying everything, but they're forgetting something that they would not normally forget. They're driving and getting lost, and it's happening a lot. We do memory testing. Now, if the memory testing is okay, it doesn't mean they have dementia. It's what we call MCI, mild cognitive impairment. And that tells us, look, this person is on the road to dementia. So it's too much to talk about, but just remember, and I'm going to give you one analogy, which is important. When you're born with a full tank of water. Everybody has a tank of water. But what happens with every day? Evaporation. People with dementia, they evaporate more. So as you get older, your tank is going to empty. Our tank can't go on forever. But the persons with dementia, they evaporate faster. And if you are diabetic, hypertensive, smoke, high cholesterol, that's like taking an ice pick and putting holes in the tank. So you're not only evaporating, but you're evaporating and losing. Mm. So the key is to not have those ice picks. Mm. I hope that answers the question.
Mm. Thank you so much. I'm very sure that you would have answered it. And I love the analogy, because, I mean, some persons may not really understand, you know, the medical terms and it'd be how things are explained. But I like that. I like the tank of water. But let me come back to my question, Dr. Pandey. When my daughter was 4 years old, she got a fever, right? And she had the fever for a few days. I gave her the Panadol or something like that, Panadine or something like that. And then after a few days, she lost her sight. After like about 5 or 6 days, she lost her sight. Well, you know, we were running around like headless chicken because, I mean, we didn't know anything. And then I took her to a specialist who sees about eyes. And, well, before that, I carried her to the hospital. They tried to take bone marrow or something from
no, called a lumbar puncture,
right?
Which is where they would take a needle, and that's quite appropriate because if you have a fever and you have a neurological deficit, you have to worry about meningitis.
Right.
So that's quite appropriate.
Okay. So right. So that was done, and then she was given this thing. Steroids. She was given steroids to probably fix whatever it was.
Maybe she had raised pressure within the brain, so that's why they gave her steroids.
Right. And when we went to see her eye specialist and he took the pictures in the back, he saw that the nerve that connected from... Right, it was swollen, and then like the... What is this again, Moy? You see, look at forgetting. it actually worked, but what I wanted to find out is...
Let's take a look and measure your tank.
My tank is about 3/4. But what I wanted to find out is, does that have a long-term effect, or like when she gets older?
Unlikely, because you did the right thing. She got the fever, you got that dealt with. If you didn't do that and she continued to have high fevers for numerous days, then they would have been damaged. She did the absolute right thing.
Okay, so the possibility exists where it may not
very unlikely
again.
Very, very unlikely.
Okay, all right. Wanted to get that one out of the way because I didn't really understand. But thanks for your analogy with the tank and everything. I'm good with that. Guys, you can call us. You can call the doctors. Any medical questions you would like answered, you can call us right now on 627-3223 or 625-2257. You can even send us a WhatsApp message on 3061065. Now, Dr. Ram, because I know you wanted to speak more about strokes.
Yes. Dr. Pandey, I wanted to know, between the onset of symptoms and time for medical treatment, for instance, if you have an ischemic stroke, one caused by a blood clot, what time frame do you have to save brain tissue?
Well, the standard literature is 4.5 hours, right? Meaning that if a patient has a stroke and you know the onset, you have 4.5 hours from that onset to administer what we call clot busters. But the sooner you give it, the better the response, because less brain tissue. In some patients who qualify, you can extend this up to 8 to 12 hours by doing a procedure known as a thrombectomy, whereby they take a needle and they either go through the hand or the groin into the brain, and they are able to extract the clot that is causing the problem. But we should not aim to get so far out. We should seek earlier treatment and start with the clot busters.
In Trinidad and Tobago, what is like the basically the amount epidemiology with respect to strokes amongst our population?
Funny you should mention that. I was part of a research conglomerate, a research group that just finished a study where we looked at the amount of strokes in some of the public institutions. And for the period January 1st, 2022 to December 31st, 2022, we got something like about, 735 strokes coming through the emergency room for the year. So more than two strokes per day. But in actuality, it's more, because we have to consider other hospitals, right? So there was a statistic many, many, many years ago where they said something like 6 to 8, but I think it can be more.
Do patients who reach in time, do they have complete recovery or partial recovery?
There are some patients without treatment that they have full recovery, because sometimes the body corrects for itself. But unfortunately, for lots of patients, there are catastrophic neurological deficits, such as weakness. Sometimes some people are unable to speak, some people are unable to swallow or live independently.
And what are some of the medication that we use after someone has a stroke? How do we normally use what patients will call blood thinners?
Yes, so after a stroke, your aim is to prevent another one. And that's why we use some blood thinners. And depending on the source of the clot, whether it's from the heart or whatever, we may escalate that to what we call anticoagulants. But very importantly, 25% of strokes has its origin in an artery in the neck known as the carotid artery. And you can take, if it's significantly blocked, whether you take medications or you don't take medications, you are going to be at a high risk of stroke. So it's very important after a stroke, you get an ultrasound of the neck to ensure that there's no residual clot there.
Doc, I have a question from someone on WhatsApp. They said, good morning to the doctors. Good morning, Carrie V, everyone. Since I was a child, I started having deja vu, but not knowing how to explain it to my parents. It was trying to recall something that happened that never happened, but it happened the exact way I remembered it afterwards. At 18 years old, I developed tonic-clonic epilepsy. Is there a link?
Yes, absolutely. There are four parts of the brain. You have the front of the brain, you have the back of the brain called the occipital, you have the top of the brain called the parietal, and just by your ear, which is called the temporal. The temporal lobe is called the psychic lobe. And whenever you have speeches of déjà vu, or the opposite of déjà vu is called jamais vu. Now, I'm not very good in French, so I may have pronounced it wrong. So in déjà vu, in jamais vu, something that you should know is unfamiliar to you, the opposite of déjà vu, or what we call experiential symptoms. Some people feel like they're levitating, their body is leaving them. Those are signs of seizures originating in the temporal lobe. And again, my final analogy, picture a pool. If you take a pebble and you throw it, you get a small ripple. That's the déjà vu. You take a big boulder and you throw it, you get a big splash and water comes out. That's the big seizure. So what happens is your pool is the brain. And when the big pebble becomes the small pebble, turns into the big boulder, that's when the small seizure escalates into the tonic-clonic. So that patient actually has what is called a focal seizure with secondary generalization, but their problem lies in the temporal lobe.
I have another one, Dr. Rambo, because I'm seeing or I'm having a lot of fine spider veins on both legs. Can you please advise on how to address this?
Usually the treatment of spider veins is the gold standard is sclerotherapy, where we use a sclerosant, which is an agent that basically forms a little blood clot inside of the vein so that the vein can die and then it's reabsorbed. So there are many different sclerosants we use. The more common one is polidocanol. So if they want to get rid of the spider veins, we need to have a look, but sometimes they have usually varicose veins as well. So we treat both concomitantly.
All right. We have a call here. Let's take this one. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning. Can I speak to the doctor?
Sure. You're speaking live on Freedom.
Yes. Dr. Pandey, I got up one morning and one of my right leg was feeling a little heavy. Then the left leg also felt a little heavy. I walk normally. There's a little pain on the head off and on. I was told that probably I got a slight stroke while sleeping. I didn't recognize it. Could you enlighten me as to what that could be? I noticed that the legs, they're getting smaller. I seem as though the muscles are being interfered with.
This is very unlikely to be a stroke. The reason why is strokes tend to be what we call unilateral, meaning that one side of the body is affected. It's also too very unlikely for a stroke to cause muscle wasting. So I would actually think that this is a spinal issue, your lower spine. And that sounds more likely than a stroke because your symptoms are progressive. A stroke hits you, you get a symptom and that's it. So you have progressive symptoms from one side onto the other side with the muscles becoming small. This is probably a spinal issue.
I'm walking normally. I cannot walk the distance that is the walk before. I feel
correct. Pain. That's called spinal claudication.
So
you need to see me and you need an MRI scan of your lumbar spine, or if not me, you see someone similar to me.
I have done an MRI. I have the results.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Dr. Pandey, can you provide your contact details then so that patients can reach you?
We'll do that off here.
Okay, no problem.
All right. So, Dr. Rambo, because Dr. Pandey, I want to thank you all so much for being on Doctors on Call. We do this again next week, same time, same place.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.